move on to the second case of the morning. The original second case was vacated. The next case is United States versus Bernard Briscoe and Ernest Brooks. Let's wait till everybody gets cleared out here. Okay, is that just Merlinski? Okay, proceed, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you for affording me the opportunity to be before you today. My name is John Smolinski. I represent Ernest Brooks, the appellant in this matter. My client is 27 years old and was sentenced to 30 years incarceration, specifically for a conviction, or actually a plea to a conspiracy to distribute and possess with intent to distribute more than 5 kilograms of cocaine and 50 grams of cocaine base. Specifically, Your Honors, this is a very narrow appeal. It has to do with the application of Federal Sentencing Guideline 4B1.1. Specifically, I believe the standard of review is de novo, and actually it's factually driven in that I think what you have to do is take a look at exactly the criminal history that Mr. Brooks would have under that provision as opposed to just working it up generally. In this case, specifically, he was a career offender because he had 2 past drug convictions. So he falls into 4B1.1 by virtue of those 2 past drug convictions, controlled substance convictions. He automatically attains a level of a criminal history category level of 6 under 4B1.1. Then what we do is we go ahead and we take a look at what the offense level would be. Well, under 4B1.1, it indicates that if, in fact, he has a statutory maximum sentence of life, then what we're going to have to do is denote a level 37 to the offense conduct. What happened here, Your Honor, quite frankly, was there was a other offense workup of the, I guess, of the offense level, which puts us to a level 45 specifically under the PSR. And our argument is specifically this. It's no more and it's no less. Our argument is saying that 4B1.1 does not afford that application. It says if you're going to use that section, that particular section, then you have to apply that level. There is some language indicating that if, in fact, there is an other application that is lower than level 37, then that level has to be applied, but not one that's greater. I would like to direct this...
Look. Section 4B1 directs the court to apply the offense level from that table if it is greater than the otherwise applicable offense level.
True.
The language pretty clearly suggests that if the offense level from the career offender table is not greater, then the court should use the otherwise applicable level.
I believe, Your Honor, in fact, and the government has pointed it out in their brief, there is a case out of the 11th Circuit that addresses that specifically. However, I would like to direct your attention to U.S. Versus Gay, and that's out of the 10th Circuit, and specifically there's dicta in that opinion that indicates that it's clear that the offense level provision contains no cross-reference designation and does not appear in the portion of the guidelines entitled base offense level or specific offense characteristic. Thus, by virtue of 4B1.1, it does not cross-reference 2D1.1D, 2D2.1B, or 2A4.1C. What that is to say, Your Honor, is there is no cross-reference on 4B1.1 to get us into that analysis that you're referring to.
Neither of you cited to this Gay case, did you?
I think it is in the government's brief, Your Honor. I think that the government did cite it. I think it was on page 42. The cite specifically would be 240F.
It isn't in the government's
initial brief. Specifically, Your Honor, my brief lays out the proposition basically, and I'm citing United States.
Page 43 is the conclusion. It isn't in the in the appendix. So,
well,
go ahead.
I'd ask that the court take that under advisement.
Well, then you file a 28J of supplemental.
Yeah,
supplemental.
I will, Your Honor. But I did want to point out to you, Your Honor, I cited this case That is United States versus Hill. And in my brief, and basically what that case stands for is the proposition that if there isn't a constitutional violation, that the court is bound basically by the sentencing guidelines that are promulgated by the Sentencing Commission. And it's our position, quite frankly, that there is no authority, and this is basically our argument, it's very narrow, that you can use an other offense analysis here. I'd also just like to note that this is technically an issue of first impression in the circuit, and that's why I thought it was necessary to bring it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ransom? Ransom?
May it please the court, I'm William H. Ransom on behalf of the defendant appellant in this matter, Bernard Briscoe. This case comes to the court from the Western District of Wisconsin after a jury trial in which Mr. Briscoe was convicted of one count of conspiracy to distribute cocaine, in which he received a life sentence without release, and six counts of distribution of cocaine, which he received various sentences from 20 to 40 years. Your Honor, the brief we filed raised a number of issues. The two I'd like to concentrate on is what I believe was misconduct by the government in their closing argument. Specifically, I believe they misstated the law in their closing arguments. I believe they misstated the evidence. Additionally, I believe that they attempted to appeal to the passions and prejudice of the jury rather than relying on the evidence and the law therein. Additionally, I believe that the district court, by some of its intervention in this case, denied Mr. Briscoe his right to counsel, insofar as the district court limited his ability to communicate with his counsel, and thereby not allowing him to have sufficient input into his defense.
Mr. Ransom,
yes.
Another issue that you brought up is the ineffectiveness, the alleged ineffectiveness of counsel. And what I'd like to ask you is if you are certain that you wish to press that on direct appeal, if you believe that we really have a complete enough record here to assess the ineffectiveness claim.
I do not wish to withdraw it at this time, Your Honor.
But you know it can't be raised on habeas if it's considered here. That's the problem, if there is one. Maybe there isn't. If there's a complete record and we can look at it and assess the argument, then that's okay. But you can't come back on habeas and say, hey, we forgot some things or we need a hearing and all that sort of thing.
And add the affidavits. Considering the court's point, I guess I will withdraw it at this time. Returning back to my initial argument, Judge, Your Honors, I believe that what the government did in their closing argument was pronounced and persistent misconduct. First, turning to the fact that they misstated the law as far as the jury instructions in that in their closing argument. The government said, explained to the jury a number of what they said were going to be the instructions by the district court, which weren't in fact the instructions. First one is they stepped up in front of the jury and said that if you plan to commit a crime, you're guilty of conspiracy. And they preceded this, and in their brief to this court, they said that this statement was basically taken out of context and wasn't fully explained, but I believe their brief shows that, in fact, that in the context immediately preceding them telling the jury this, they told the jury that you will be instructed by the court, and then they went on to say that conspiracy is if you plan to commit a crime, then you've committed conspiracy. And of course, this is not what the jury's instructions are to conspiracy. They're more complex than that. They have a number of elements that the jury has to look at. Unfortunately, doing that, the government narrowed their burden, and the jury could have taken it that that's all they really needed to look to, with relying on what the government said. Additionally, they, again, in the context of what they were saying, they said you'll be instructed that you don't have to have a formal written agreement in order to have a conspiracy. Well, that may be true, but again, that is not the jury instructions in which the court would give as to what to look at. Of course, you can look at the circumstances and the words and conduct, but at no time does the court say you don't have to have a written agreement. And once again, I believe these misstatements narrowed the government's burden and divide.
I'm not sure why that's a misstatement, that you don't have to have a written agreement. Why isn't that the law?
Well, you don't have to. That is a fact. You don't have to have a written agreement. But what the government did is immediately prior to saying that, it says this was going to be the jury instructions from the court. I don't believe those are the jury instructions that the court gives regarding it, and therefore was narrowing their burden. Besides misstatements of law, I believe that the government also misstated some of the evidence before the court in saying that what the weight of the cocaine, the evidence would show as far as the weight of the cocaine. I believe the weight of the cocaine, as far as the conspiracy trial, all the evidence showed that was merely speculative. The government tried to elicit testimony as to the size of the packages and what may be in the packages as observed by the witnesses, but the witnesses were never definitive as to weight or as to what the substances were. They just said it was consistent with cocaine. And finally, during closing arguments, as far as the evidence, they told the jury that all the witnesses said that Mr. Brooks, the co-defendant with Mr. Briscoe on the original indictment, received all his drugs from Mr. Briscoe. Well, the witnesses in the case did not testify to that. And those things go right to counts 2 through 7, which had to do with the direct distribution of the cocaine and the cocaine base. Again, I believe that these were misstatements. As the court pointed out in Berger versus U.S. and cited in my brief, the average juror is apt to give more weight to the words of the government because they view the government as an impartial agent seeking justice, not as just one litigant who's trying to win their case. And so I believe these misstatements go to hurting and denying my client a fair trial. Finally, I believe the government appealed to the passions of the jury wrongly instead of relying on the evidence before the court. They said to the jury that Briscoe used these women because of their weak self-esteem. There was nothing in the record to indicate that these women had weak self-esteem or one way or the other, said that these people didn't profit on it, and obviously did. The witnesses were all admitted drug dealers, and if you were to believe them, they said that they received money and rent. I'm not admitting that, but that's what they said in their testimony. So accordingly, I believe that the multiple misstatements of law and the multiple misstatements of the evidence show that there is pronounced and persistent misconduct. Just to touch briefly on the district court intervened in several disagreements between Mr. Briscoe and his defense counsel. In doing so, the court limited how Mr. Briscoe could interact with his defense counsel during the course of the trial, that is, give input. At one point, the district court...
Well, wasn't the attorney asking for help from the court?
Well, the attorney did ask for help from the court, and it was in the context of the attorney going before the court and saying, hey, my client's trying to talk to me while I'm trying to listen to the witnesses. Could you please order him not to do that?
Right.
Well,
wasn't she trying to help?
She was trying to help.
No,
she was trying to help his attorney. I mean, the attorney for the defendant brought brought before the court multiple problems that he was having. Mr. Briscoe obviously wanted to impart something contemporaneously to his counsel. His counsel didn't want that and went to the court and said, please, you know, tell him to stop. I don't believe that's the proper proper thing for the court to do.
Well, can he make sure that he has the chance to consult after each cross-examination, for instance?
Well, she suggested that. But she also didn't suggest it to Mr. Briscoe. She suggested it to his counsel.
Well, tell me this. Is there any evidence that this limitation that was imposed by Judge Crabb actually prevented Mr. Briscoe from communicating something to his counsel, or are you just saying this was a possibility?
Well, I would have to say the record doesn't show positively that there was any limitation. But if you look at the record further, in which the district court further told Mr. Briscoe that if he persisted in talking to his counsel, he'd be removed from the chamber, would have to watch the remainder. My time's up, and if I could just finish answering.
Sure.
He'd be removed from the chambers and have to watch the rest of the proceedings on closed-circuit TV. I think it can only be determined that, in fact, any communication was killed at that point. Mr. Briscoe certainly had the right to every reason to believe that the district court was serious, that if he talked to his counsel, he would be removed. And that alone, I believe, is enough to show that he was denied that free two-way communication with his counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Robert Anderson. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. I have the privilege of representing the United States in this matter. Let me deal with the issues, especially the ones that the court is focused on in this case. Mr. Briscoe has challenged the conduct and the outcome of his trial, of course. I'll deal with the last issue that was addressed first. The court's limitations on Mr. Briscoe's communication with his counsel. I would note the record clearly demonstrates that this was a reasonable and a necessary limitation on Mr. Briscoe's communication, and more importantly, different than any other circumstance in Getters or Perry versus Leak, this was requested by the defense attorney to help him be able to defend Mr. Briscoe. He was being essentially interfered with by Mr. Briscoe's interrupting him when he was trying to pay attention to witnesses on the stand. All the district court did, all the Judge Crabb did, was to say to Mr. Briscoe, look, you can't interrupt your attorney. You got to let him do his job. He has to pay attention to these witnesses. He needs to object when there's improper questions asked by the government, if there are improper questions asked by the government. And he needs to be able to understand what the witness is saying to adequately cross-examine them. That was being interfered with. This is not a case of a judge interjecting herself sua sponte into the relationship between the client and the attorney. And if you look at look at the record and even the in-camera meetings between Mr. Briscoe, his counsel, and the judge discussing their difficulties and problems and why the attorney was saying he couldn't do certain things that Mr. Briscoe wanted him to do, it's very clear that Judge Crabb listened to both sides. She gave Mr. Briscoe ample opportunity, and the transcript goes on for pages of him explaining, giving him a chance to explain to the judge, and the judge finally saying, look, you just can't interrupt in that way. And in the transcript transcript 178, I think it's the third day of trial, page 180, she says to them, look, I'm not saying you can't communicate with your attorney, but wait until the testimony is done. Give me a high sign, and I will give you an opportunity to talk, to consult. You can tell them what questions you want asked or answered from the witnesses, what things you're concerned about, and the attorney will do that. But the attorney is the one that has to make a choice as to what is appropriate to ask and what to present to the court. So there is nothing in this record that demonstrates that Mr. Briscoe was actually unable to either write down questions on a pad of paper, pass them over to his attorney, or communicate with his attorney in the manner that the judge suggested that limited his right to counsel. And so this is even though the United States Supreme Court in Perry versus Leak had found that a 15-minute prohibition on them communicating with one another was not a violation of the right to counsel, we don't even have something as restrictive as that. So there is no violation there. Then I did want to comment on Mr. Brooks's with regard to the issue in Mr. Brooks. You only get to the appellant's conclusion, Mr. Brooks' conclusion about the guidelines, if you ignore the obvious and clear language of the guideline itself. And I
do you know this Gay case?
Yes, and I do apologize. When you pointed out that it's not in the table, I looked, and you're correct. The Tenth Circuit and Eleventh Circuit in the table, for some reason, our software or whatever we use that doesn't reflect that pulls up those cases didn't put them in there, but they are in the brief. Gay is cited at page 40 of the government's brief, and the U.S. versus Robinson, which is the 11th Circuit case, is cited as the next page, page 41. So we did put them in the brief, but somehow there was a glitch, and we didn't catch that in editing the brief, and I apologize.
Will you supplement that? Give us proper table of contents then?
I will, Your Honor.
So we can put that in the brief?
I will.
I assume that's the only error you ran across there, because we want to make sure we've got it intact. We don't want to go paging through looking for this.
Right. I will double-check it for any other errors. I noticed there was a typographical error.
I don't care about that. Yeah. The table of contents has to be accurate.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. And then as to the comments of the government, all of the statements which regarded the law, characterization of the law, and our statements regarding the facts and reasonable inferences to be drawn from the facts are supported by either what the judge did instruct or what the record reflected in terms of facts.
I gather there was no evidence that Mr. Brooks was supplied by anyone other than Mr. Risco.
Right, and that is what I was referring to when I said all of the witnesses. Now, perhaps that was poor to characterize it as all the witnesses. What I was referring to was all the witnesses who testified about Mr. Brooks getting drugs and selling drugs testified that he got them from Mr. Briscoe. Obviously, when we put the lab analyst up on the stand and he testified about testing the drugs, he didn't know anything about that relationship, so my saying all the witnesses was, as a technical matter, not correct. But what I meant was the witnesses who had that personal knowledge. And I would, as an initial matter, with regard to any of the comments or the arguments which we did make at trial, I would note that there were no objections made at trial by the defense attorney defendant, and therefore the review of this court is for any plain error. And the comment or the summary of the law that was stated during the closing arguments, which counsel has referred to, if you plan to commit a crime, you're guilty of a conspiracy. That's essentially what the instruction does say. The instruction that the judge gave to the jurors was a conspiracy is an agreement between two or more persons to accomplish an unlawful purpose. Now, of course, I substituted unlawful purpose with crime, but it was not verbatim the exact instruction, but it was the instruction and the essence of the instruction that the judge gave to the jury. And there certainly is no plain error in that. Conspiracy does not have to be a formal written contract. That is consistent with the instruction given by the judge, and it is also consistent with this court's the case law in this court in United States versus Hickok, which I cited in my brief, a 1996 case. And all the other comments that he made or arguments he made about the factual arguments made by government at trial about the quantities, I went through and cited in my brief exactly how this was over. It was over 5 kilograms with Sarah Weyer's testimony alone, and I cited each page and each reference that she made to how many kilograms she brought back, which alone was, I think it was 6 kilograms when we totaled that up in the brief. And she was not, of course, the only witness. There were more witnesses than that. We already addressed where Mr. Brooks got his drugs from and the witnesses who testified to that, Mr. Neal, Mr. Maddox, Ms. Weyer. So in short, all of those, if you look at my brief, are supported and cited. The ineffective assistance of counsel, I understand, has been withdrawn, so I won't delve into that issue. If there are no other questions regarding sufficiency of evidence or any of these other issues, I'll rest on the arguments made in the brief.
Okay, thanks. And I believe both of your times have expired. So this case will be taken under advisement.